All right, everyone. It's Monday, January 27th. You're tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It's a lovely day in the neighborhood. I'm going to describe today in five words. Coronavirus, Kobe Bryant, John Bolton. That is the weekend. That is the weekend in a nutshell. And my daughter lives in Shanghai, so coronavirus comes first because of that. I have a phenomenal piece by Charlie Pierce about Kobe Bryant and what I just said about John Bolton. He doesn't need a subpoena. He doesn't need a book. He just needs a spine. Start talking. Start talking. And frankly, you know what they should have done? I know that Simon & Schuster has that book on tape. I know there's an audio version. They should release that. You want to hear his voice? Okay. Start reading out loud. Wow. Wouldn't that be brilliant? That would be absolutely – you don't have to even bring him in. You just turn to page 200 and well, whatever it is, push the button and go, okay, John, in your voice. And you get to hear him say it. I mean, if he doesn't have a spine, at least we can like make some money on this, John, and you can read your audiobook. Just amazing.
That's great.
It is great. It is great. So real quickly, and then I'm going to do the Charlie Pierce and sort of tell me what's on your mind.
Well, certainly Kobe Bryant was on my mind, and that is a very saddening thing. He was just a stunningly talented athlete, and I love to watch people who are geniuses at anything do their thing, whether it's brilliant minds or pianists or musicians, ball players. And Kobe was a real master. And then, you know, he really turned his life around at the end and was doing good things for humanity. And that's certainly an admirable thing.
He's the kind of role model. And his love of the world. I mean, China. I mean, he had a sense of the planet when it came to even his sport and his understanding. And apparently he set up clinics in China so that young Chinese, you know, players can learn to play. I mean, it's an understanding that very few people have, let alone professional players.
And
like
of course,
him.
He had lots of clinics and stuff coaching with girls' teams.
Yeah, his daughters.
Yeah. Girls are certainly second-class citizens when it comes to sports in this country for decades, even though they bring more honor to the United States in a lot of ways than the men's teams do. The women's soccer team
let me just read these four sentences from Charlie Pierce. So I love Charlie Pierce. Charlie Pierce right now writes for Esquire magazine. Mm-hmm. He I don't know if he's still on, but there's a show on NPR called Only a Game that's about sports. Mm-hmm. And it's just fabulous. And so Esquire, he wrote a piece. It's poignant. It's emotional. It's magical. It's so freaking honest. It's so Charlie. And here's what he writes. This is the title. It is a terrible irony that Kobe Bryant should fall from the sky. That's the title. Mm-hmm. In the end, we all have to judge whether one of the world's greatest athletes corrected the mistakes immediately and beautifully. We're talking about the rape charge.
Right.
The late poet and singer Jim Carroll could really play. He came up in New York in the era of Connie Hawkins, Lou Alcindor, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. He ran as an equal with playground legends like Pee Wee Kirkland and Herman Helicopter Knowles. At about the same time, he got interested in writing and in heroin. But he still produced the greatest line ever written about a game. Listen to this. Mm-hmm. In basketball, wrote Carroll, you can correct your mistakes immediately and beautifully and in midair. Oh, my God. Anyway, and then he goes on to say, oh, my God, I'm going to cry. That line seemed to hover around me when the news came in about the death of Kobe Bryant and eight other people, including his daughter, Gianna, in a helicopter crash in the hills around L.A. Kobe was 41, Gianna 13. Bryant's life was marked by a stunning ability to play the game that so entranced Carroll that even in a heroin fog, Carroll could cling to its beauty that had sunk so deep into his bones. To watch Bryant at his peak, in his prime, is to appreciate the terrible irony that he died in a fall from the sky.
Yeah. Oh, it's unbelievable. It's beautiful.
If you don't follow, Charlie Pierce is sometimes incredibly obnoxious. He's very direct, but he is just a remarkable writer. He has incredible memory and institutional memory, and he knows how to say things in such a way that he's honest about our flaws, but he celebrates our strength. And he did it in such a remarkable way with Kobe Bryant. I had dinner last night with someone. We were talking about politicians and their inability to sort of talk about their flaws and, you know, Donald Trump denying that he has any. And I told the guy that was at dinner last night that I wanted all politicians to file two statements just before they run for office. One is a personal financial statement, and the other is a personal failure statement.
Right.
And I don't want the cult of personality. I don't want the cult of personality for Donald Trump. I don't want the cult of personality for Bernie Sanders. I don't want the cult of personality for Mayor Pete. We are human. We are flawed. I'm not asking you to create a cult around me. I'm asking you to respect me, to believe in my judgment, and at times recognize you will be disappointed. That's what I want.
Right.
Oh, God.
Right. So one other thing I'd like to mention, and it's a little more upbeat, and that is, well, partially upbeat, that is that nine families who were separated on the southwest border by Donald Trump's policy have come back and been reunited with their children.
Oh, wow.
Nine parents have come back and been reunited with their children, and it was a wonderful and tearful reunion apparently at LA airport under direct orders from a U.S. district judge that they had to bring folks back if they could find them. But they only found nine. And there are at least 471 parents that were deported without their children that we know of.
Right.
And obviously, a lot of them have yet to be reunited with their children.
Well,
and
record-keeping is something the Trump administration doesn't believe in.
Well, the administration acknowledged that it didn't do an adequate job of keeping records of who they separated from whom and where they separated the families to. So that's just stunningly inhuman.
Brown people are expendable in Trump's eyes.
Yeah, yeah. There's still – we don't even know how many children there are because for each of the 471 parents that were deported, there's at least one and maybe three or who knows how many children. I certainly saw 3,200 of them in Homestead.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a lot of kids.
That's a lot of kids.
But at least nine of them are back, and the U.S. courts, at least this one, is functioning in a way to do justice. So there is a little ray of light and
exactly.
hope.
All right, everyone, it is our Rethink the Week. We have a great panel of guests. Three professors walk into our radio studio. Well, not exactly. Two by phone. One will be walking in, Dean Spiliotis. So much to talk about. I can't even quite comprehend it. But we'll be joined shortly by phone with Stephen Pimper. He is a CARSI fellow of public policy, a specialist in poverty and low income. He also teaches at UNH Manchester. We'll also be joined by Val Endres. She is a political communications specialist and professor at Rhode Island College. And of course, as you know, Dean Spiliotis joins us every week. He is a civic scholar and a presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University and a regular on NHPR. I will introduce them now and then we'll get them on the phone. I'm not going to go through that again. I do have to say something. So I have been like slightly panicked because of coronavirus. And the reason I am slightly panicked because of the coronavirus is that my daughter lives in Shanghai. And we've been sort of having these interesting conversations. She, because of Chinese New Year's, most people had abandoned Shanghai for the holiday. She, however, had stayed home. And in fact, they're preventing people from coming back because they don't want to spread the disease, which means here they are vacationing and now they're being asked to sort of stay in place, which is even more of a challenge than if you had never left home. And my daughter's lucky because she had not left Shanghai. But when I talked to her yesterday morning, we were talking about like what was she hearing. And, you know, part of the problem is can you always believe the Chinese government? You know, they're not always the most forthcoming in information. And she has sources within the medical community all over China because she's actually taught all over China. So she's getting some accurate information. One of the things she told me yesterday morning was that they were closing down all the elementary schools in China until the end of February as a reaction and a concern about the coronavirus. She also said that she was going to the embassy to get on the list. And I saw a story this morning that in just one day they saw 761 new cases of coronavirus. And I sent her a message this morning and I said, come home, I'll pay for the ticket, just come home. And she said, I have to process, Mom. And one of the big issues for her is she's married to a young man from Shanghai. Her family, half her family now is in China.
Mm-hmm.
And what is home? When I said, come home, what is home? So that's part of the problem. All right, joining us right now to talk about Rethink the Week is our two guests. Stephen Pimpare is from UNH Manchester, and I already introduced you, Stephen, so they already know who you are. Val Andres, Rhode Island College, I already introduced you, so they know who you are.
Okay.
And now about to sit down is Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University. What an interesting, interesting weekend. I mean, from the Kobe Bryant story, and I read to my audience the opening sentences from Charlie Pierce's amazing piece at Esquire magazine, and I posted it on Facebook. I urge everyone to read it. It is brilliant. It is brilliant and emotional. And of course, you know, and of course, Kobe Bryant had a connection to China too. So there's part of the reason why I have this real thing, you know, the coronavirus, my daughter, Kobe Bryant. But I guess we need to start, you guys, with maybe a more important story. And the most important story right now is, I think, what's happening with the impeachment hearing. So I'm going to start with you, Val Endres, because we haven't talked to you in a dog's age. John Bolton. I posted on Facebook this morning. You know, we all know his book is coming out. Boy, he's going to be selling that book like left and right. I even suspect that Simon & Schuster, I was saying this to Ken, has probably required him to have an audio version of the book. So even if he doesn't want to testify, we could just turn to page 226 and just turn it on. You know what I mean? And we'll get John Bolton in his own words, in his own voice. But it is how do Republicans survive this? I mean, I understand there isn't a Republican Party anymore, and we saw it happen. Just as a sidebar for you, there has been a long time sort of quasi-anti-Trumper who is incredibly well-respected in New Hampshire named Steve Dupree. He is admired. He is loved. He's done more for the state. He's been a national committeeman for a long time.
Five terms, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Four or five terms. He just lost. We don't know what the vote was, but we hear it was overwhelming. He just lost in his opportunity to, again, be the national committeeman, and he got swept away. And he had a lot of really important and powerful Republicans supporting his national committee status. But obviously, in the time of Trump, not only did they have the biggest turnout at this vote than they've ever seen ever in Republican history, but he was kicked out. And that sort of tells you a little bit about what's happening to whatever is left of what used to be called the GOP. But I'm just trying to figure out, how do they survive this? They may get reelected, but reelected for what purpose?
Well, I think your question is a little bit optimistic there. And I read a study a couple of months ago that I was curious about where independents get their news. And one of the things that I found out is, in addition to conservatives, they're much more likely, up to 70%, get their news from Fox rather than CNN or MSNBC. Wow. And one thing that's important and tied to that with the impeachment trial is that Fox did not air the closing arguments.
Yes, I know.
And so they censored Schiff. And so the question is, are they getting a full picture? Certainly Trump's base is not. But sometimes what makes the difference in senatorial races or congressional races are the independents. And if they're getting most of their news from an outlet that has a biased perspective, that certainly is going to impact people's attitudes. And we know that Donald Trump's, you know, most people want to see evidence up to mm-hmm. two-thirds. But Donald Trump is holding steady with his popularity.
So, Stephen, as I was thinking about what Val just said, I can't believe I'm going to talk about him. Michael Bloomberg. Mm. And let me tell you why I'm talking about Michael Bloomberg. So when I ran for governor back in the early 1990s, there was a powerful, wealthy guy from Texas named Ross Perot. And what did he do? He did those infomercials. Remember? I don't know if you were a child, but he did these infomercials. And it was all about the debt, and there were pie charts. And so he didn't have to – he wouldn't get attention from the media, but he could buy his attention. He could actually provide us with content wherever he thought we needed to see it. So if it was on a news show, he could have his infomercial. If it was on a sports show, he could have his infomercial. So in a way, he directed all our eyes to him because he didn't have to depend on a news outlet or a free media strategy. Do you think that Michael Bloomberg could do something that will undermine Fox's complete stranglehold on access to information, because not only does he have an unlimited checkbook, but he also has some brilliant consultants and lobbyists that work for him, and they know exactly how to target an audience. And even if independents are watching Fox, they're not watching Fox, Val, 24 hours a day. They're watching ESPN. They're watching sports. They're watching some sort of a show on, I don't know, some, you know, I don't know, whatever show, HBO. So do you think that in some way, Stephen, that Michael could do something that the party right now financially or maybe politically doesn't have the capacity to do?
I think all ends equal, the answer is probably no. And what I have in my mind is sort of what we know from folks in political psychology talking about things like motivated reasoning, right? It's like sort of the kinds of citizens, voters, and potential voters that you are talking about are already inhabiting a closed information loop in a world in which hyper-partisan polarization makes them actually more likely to hold on to their pre-existing beliefs when confronted with contrary evidence rather than challenge their mind. This is, I think, in some ways, one of the fundamental dilemmas that we face right now as a democracy, and the ways in which sort of the information environment is so deeply polluted, and the ways in which means by which we may create meaningful, open dialogue in which people come to understand what's in their best interest and learn how to act on it. We don't have too many of those spaces right now, which makes, even if you've got hundreds of millions of dollars to spend, the odds that you're able to have meaningful impact, I think, are very limited.
So, Dean, it's so amazing you said this, because I just lived what you just said this morning. So this morning, Dean, on my Facebook page, as I'm thinking about the coronavirus and how we don't have – we got rid of the idea of a national, like, medical emergency, health emergency under the Trump administration. We used to actually have a division that was focusing on that. The man who was in charge of it in 2018 resigned or retired. John Bolton eliminated it when he was the head of the national security. And so I was thinking about that, and I'm thinking about the coronavirus, and everybody's sort of beginning to panic. So I wrote the following. Healthcare is a national security issue! Exclamation point. The climate crisis is a national security issue! Exclamation point. Trump needs to go if we are to survive. So here is what one of the Republicans who joins my Facebook page writes. Can you prove climate change? After he wrote that, there were 29 replies to that statement about can you prove? And he actually says, I have never experienced climate change. It does not exist. So in a lot of ways, I'm listening to what I'm hearing from Stephen, and I'm going, okay, I'm shipping you to Australia. Write me notes. Mm-hmm. You know, so in a way, Stephen is right. It's like all the information in the world, and he had 29 replies, 29, and none of them penetrated. In fact, it hardened him.
Yeah, the psychological desire to eliminate cognitive dissonance is very strong in the human composition. I see it all the time, and often the more information there is, the more saturated the environment is, the more chaotic the environment is, the harder people work to filter out the noise, to filter out that dissonance. You know, it's we call it, we have different names for it. We call it siloing. You know, you stay within your silo.
Right.
You know, it's interesting to me. I'm teaching intro American this term, and we're dealing with the Federalist Papers right now. And Federalist 10, James Madison's big idea is that because the country is of sufficient size, there are a multiplicity of interests. It's a pluralistic society. Like-minded individuals won't be able to find each other and carry out their plans of oppression.
But we
have the internet now,
yeah, exactly.
So like-minded individuals can find themselves,
exactly.
Each other, and reinforce
right.
These kinds of issues. So I think people have always been that way. Even pre-internet, you give somebody a selection of five polls,
right.
They're going to pick the poll that reinforces their prior
right.
belief about the candidates. The internet has just augmented it tremendously. I mean, you know, Bloomberg, this sort of hypothetical about Bloomberg, I think Stephen's right that, you know, picking off these people who are really locked down is unlikely. You know, there may be people on the margins that you may be able
right.
to sway or have some impact in a close election that could make a difference, but you don't really have a sense of how much money would he have to spend in order to do that.
And Ross Perot is 1992, before the age of social media and internet and Twitter.
Yeah, I mean, he had 19%.
And he actually changed.
But he had Larry King, actually. He had Larry King,
CNN, his infomercials, yep. And he changed Bill Clinton because yep. Bill Clinton ran on a middle class tax cut, yep. And Bill Clinton basically threw his Democrats under the bus because he raised taxes in order to address the deficit. So he actually had an impact on the candidate that ran, which is kind of shocking. But I want to turn to something else, because it's not only how we've hardened people, but you know, my political communications person. Let's talk about Mary Louise Kelly. So the NPR reporter Mary Louise Kelly is a good reporter, and she is a tough reporter. I know what it's like to be hated when you ask people tough questions, because I've experienced it, and it's chilling and frightening. But she was able to do it in a public setting, and then he dragged her into, I guess, his office, and then basically castigated her. But what I find fascinating is, who is Mike Pompeo? Because Val, when you look at his credentials and his background and where he went to school and his history, you kind of look at him and going, what happened to him? Val, it's like every ethical piece of DNA, a level of integrity, a sign of respect, it's all abandoned him because of this allegiance to Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump is a disease. He's like the coronavirus. You know, I mean, I'm really beginning to worry. I was so shocked by that, because when he pulled out the empty map and said, find Ukraine, you know, I'm looking at him going, what kind of an SOB are you? But yet this is the world in which we live, where a Secretary of State would do that to not just a respected reporter, but would do it to any reporter.
Well, you could look at this a couple of ways. And one is, you always have to ask that question. What are those people thinking who are so aligning themselves? And what's going to happen when Trump is out of office? But this is tied to just our previous conversation about a divided America. You know, not only do we find our neighborhood online and we only talk to like-minded people, but literally the demographics are showing that people move into neighborhoods depending upon their political affiliation.
Right.
So if you're talking about life after Trump, then you're not looking for that kumbaya moment when you can run as a moderate Republican. And some political scientists are questioning whether this divide can ever come together again. And so in some ways, I think Mike Pompeo is very proud of his actions here. You know, first of all, he gave the Trump folks a reinvigorated new enemy, that is NPR.
Very good.
They can rail against. And again, it's the fake media. So I think Pompeo is looking at this, even in terms of his political future, as a win-win.
Ken, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up on what Dean was saying and what Val's saying. It's really kind of frightening, not that it's news to me, that, okay, we'll never be able to change folks' minds because they're, well, the cognitive dissonance thing and only talking to people who agree with them. So my question is, what can we do about it to make the country better, and including less divided? So if you were like the democracy czar or the deity, what would you do to address it? Obviously, trying to talk people into being reasonable and rational is not going to work. So what would you do?
Well, let me just say
that. Had total power.
Let me just say, Stephen, so as I'm listening to what Ken just said and then what Val just said, let me just say about Mike Pompeo. Mike Pompeo is smart. Mike Pompeo was he the head of the CIA? Mike Pompeo was in the military. He went to West Point. We're not just talking about people who are persuadable.
He was a leader.
Thank you. He was a leader. And so if this guy can basically hollow out his soul and lose his integrity, then I'm really worried, as Ken says, Stephen, how do we come back when I understand the guy that's sort of mesmerized by Fox? What the frick is Pompeo's excuse?
So there's a strain of thought that comes out of the policy history literature. And sort of the short version cliche of it is, it's not just that politics create policy, but that policies create their own politics. And I think that's relevant here because I think that we need, instead of thinking about persuasion, we need to be thinking about power. We need to be taking seriously the observations all of us have made on this program about the effectiveness of Mitch McConnell, who is not interested in acts of persuasion or of changing minds, but is interested in developing a sophisticated understanding of the levers of power and figuring out how to move them. Pompeo is in part aligned with Trump, not of any ideological or moral commitment, because right now he understands his own personal fortunes to be tied to the fortunes of the administration.
That's
change that calculus and his behavior changes.
Dean, last point before we take a break.
Yeah, well, just to get back, Ken had asked me a question a moment ago, and you know, it's a very difficult thing to figure out. You know, how can you enforce people to have more, you know, more diverse interactions or more diverse sources of information? I mean, it's a very difficult thing to do. How to get people out of their comfort zone or talking? I mean, so many aspects of human nature are geared towards reinforcing identity, cultural identity, individual identity, community identity, and right. So getting people to break out of that or devising some kind of system in which there are greater cross currents. It's just a very difficult thing to do. There's just not any. I think it's stronger sometimes than others, and right now we're in a period where there's just a lot of this kind of reinforced polarization going on, but it's always there. It's always been there to some extent.
I wasn't even talking about necessarily how do we change their minds, given that they're not likely to change, but what do we do? I mean,
I know. I got the answer. And you know what the answer is? This is going to sound crazy. Yeah. So I read an article the other day that young people are now becoming disenchanted with social media. I don't know if it's true. I read an article, just one. But I'm just telling you right now that that's a good thing. That's a good thing because human contact matters, because talking to people matters, because somehow, you know, the whole idea of social media is that it ramps up your emotion. It doesn't give you nuance. It's instant gratification. That's not life.
Yeah.
But everyone's been living in social media, so they've been living in this bubble that's not life. And if it's true that kids are beginning to recognize that or move to something else, that may be our hope. And on that note, I need to just take a break. This is Rethink the Week on The Attitude with Arnie Arnison, producer Ken Barnes. When we come back, we'll be joined once again by Val Endres, Stephen Pimper, and Dean Spiliotis. A Little Labor History is next. We'll be right back.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1950. The cost of a first-class stamp was 3 cents. And starting on this day, one of the options for first-class postage bore the image of U.S. labor leader Samuel Gompers. The British-born Gompers was a founder and longtime head of the American Federation of Labor. The Postal Service authorized 112 million copies of the Gompers stamp. He was not the only labor leader to be commemorated with a stamp. A. Philip Randolph, head of the First National Black Union, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, was honored in 1989. 5 years later, George Meany, who led the AFL-CIO for nearly two decades, was featured. Cesar Chavez, the co-founder of the United Farm Workers, was pictured in 2003. In 2013, the U.S. Postal Service issued a series of stamps titled Made in America, Building a Nation. This set of stamps featured 12 historic black and white photos of men and women at work. One was of a welder working on the Empire State Building. Others featured a miner, a textile worker, and a railroad worker. The stamps included 11 images by Lewis Hine, a famous photographer of working people. Secretary of Labor Tom Perez said, "Stamps are like a miniature American portrait gallery. They are an expression of our values and a connection to our past. That's why it's so fitting that this series depicts Americans at work. These iconic images tell a powerful story about American economic strength and prosperity. These men and women and millions like them really did build a nation. If you could pick one working class image to be featured on a stamp, what would you choose? A politician, a labor leader, or a nurse, construction worker, or postal worker?" Labor History in Two brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. When news about global warming is grim, some people gaze into the sky and wonder whether humans could find another planet to live on. Deborah Fisher is an astronomy professor at Yale University. She has spent her career searching the stars for other planets.
My research, my job, is to find planets orbiting other stars. And I often get the comment, oh, good, you've just found another planet that we can go to. And I want to emphasize that there is no planet B for us.
She says that astronomy helps her understand just how precious and vulnerable this planet is.
We really do, I think, as astronomers, appreciate the fact that the Earth has this incredibly thin veneer of atmosphere, and it's easy to pollute.
Fisher helps lead a group called Astronomers for Planet Earth. It's made up of astronomy scientists, educators, and students who have pledged to fight climate change. They're working to educate the public about global warming and the urgent need to protect Earth, our home, and the only planet we can live on.
We just need people to come together and solve this problem.
Like Climate Connections? Subscribe to our free podcast on iTunes or other major platforms.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Can I get a witness? Can I get a witness? This is The Attitude with Artie Artis and producer Ken Barnes. Pixar music. So who sings Can I Get a Witness?
As if you didn't know, that's Marvin Gaye. Wonderful Marvin Gaye. And why do you think I was talking about getting a witness?
I know. I'm looking at a headline, everyone. John Bolton's account upends Trump's denials. But will it upend Trump? That's from the New York Times. Joining us right now in studio is Dean Spiliotis. He is a civic scholar, a presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. Also joining us by phone is Val Endres. She is a political communications specialist and professor at Rhode Island College. And Stephen Pimpare is a Carsey Institute fellow. He teaches at UNH Manchester. His area of expertise is issues of homelessness and poverty, and just a great public policy person. So as I'm thinking about all this stuff, and I'm looking at the impeachment hearing that's starting again today, you have to go to what is also sort of the big umbrella that's over all this, and that is the 2020 campaign. And I began my list of topics today, Stephen Pimpare, which was from an article from NBC News. Here is why Bernie is rising and how he could win. What I think is so fascinating to me, Stephen, is I did WGBH radio on Sunday, and Callie Crossley, it's hard for her to say that Sanders could actually be a legitimate presidential candidate. You can tell she doesn't really think that this is, and yet we had to talk about it because the numbers are growing, both in Iowa and in New Hampshire. The numbers are actually growing with African Americans. When you actually poll, not just in South Carolina, but around the country with African Americans, it's Biden and Bernie. When you see who has the highest approval ratings and trustworthiness, it's Bernie by a mile. So it's really interesting. The guy who got no free media from any of the national media outlets, who everybody poo-pooed, who the DNC would like to see disappear, for whatever reason, at least if nothing else, he could win a caucus or a primary at least in the very beginning. So, Stephen, like, what do we think about this?
Well, I don't think too much about it, honestly. There was a study that came out from some of my colleagues a couple of weeks ago at the Carsey School at UNH looking at historical accuracy of polling in New Hampshire leading up to the primary. And surprise, surprise, not particularly useful data. There have been a couple of studies that have come out recently and other historical ones looking at the both the accuracy of polling for the Iowa caucus and then the extent to which the Iowa caucus is predictive of things like winning the nomination, and also not particularly useful by way of data. What is, I think, important is something tying back to what we were talking about earlier in the ways in which all media, both micro and macro, are searching for stories to tell. They are building their own particular narrative for whatever their own individual reasons are, often to draw people's attention, to start fights, to get clicks. And I think it's a mistake to, A, not take that seriously, that the fact that media is itself a player in the election, not an observer.
Right.
But at the same time, to look for ways to dismiss those narratives and think about things that are perhaps more important and more substantive.
Okay, so before I get to you, Val, I got to turn to Dean, because Dean had a big smirk in his face as you were talking.
Well, I'll tell you why in a moment.
All right, tell me why.
No, so not because of Stephen.
I know. So as I'm listening to you, and I understand you don't like polls, and we shouldn't trust them, and we have to look at sort of Iowa in the past, but I think all past information has no relevance in this election cycle. I hate to break it to you, but
that may be true as well.
I think so. So I'm going to just disabuse you of that, that what was true before, I don't know if that's true in the era of Trump. But the reason I also say this is I have a Tufts Now poll in front of me, Dean Spiliotis, and here is the exclusive polling from Tufts. Iowa youth poised for historic caucus turnout. Youth support in Iowa highest for Sanders, followed by Warren and Buttigieg. Now, the reason I mention this is that not only are they seeing this huge potential, the biggest event in all of Iowa took place last fall, and it was when Greta showed up to talk about climate change. It was bigger than any Bernie Sanders event, Elizabeth Warren event. It was huge. Young people came in from everywhere. For the first time ever in Iowa caucus history, 17-year-olds who will turn 18 in November are able to participate in this caucus. That has never happened before. They are now inspired by the cover of Time magazine with a Greta on the Time. And as Val Endres will know, ever since Parkland, we have been in awe of the courage of young people. They are brilliant. They show the way. They are fearless, and they understand the power of their voices and their bodies.
But so, do they vote?
But well, all right, right. So now go to Dean.
It's a great question. And as you were talking about this, I was thinking about a couple of things. I was thinking about Howard Dean in 2004, and the army of young voters in Iowa with the orange caps. I think it was, if you remember, who never materialized. Now that being said, it's a different time now. The technology is different. Students seem to be in a period where they're more active. They certainly turned out for Barack Obama in 2008. So it's certainly a possibility. I wouldn't dismiss it, and he's for a variety of reasons he's very popular with younger voters. And Stephen's point on the polling is well taken as well. In New Hampshire, we've had a lot of issues over the years trying to gauge what's actually going to happen. You know, that being said, Bernie certainly could win Iowa. He could also win New Hampshire. If he gets even close to his performance the last time here in New Hampshire, he'll do quite well. But overall, this race just still feels really fluid to me at this point. I mean, there are a couple of different individuals who have an opportunity. I guess, one thing we talk about is Elizabeth Warren. She's kind of fallen out of the conversation a little bit. She did get the Register endorsed her?
The Des Moines
Register.
So that she would address inequality. Yeah. That was what they
saw. So she got that. But she seemed, most of the conversation that I'm hearing right now is all about Sanders surging and Biden and Buttigieg. And, Warren seems to consistently be in fourth place now. So I don't know what that means for her if she finishes fourth in the first two.
Only 1 point behind.
No, it's very close. It's certainly within the margin of error. Absolutely. Right. The reason why I was smirking, because literally as you were talking about Bernie may win, I was reading the first paragraph of an article in The Atlantic. And the title of the article, Bernie Can't Win.
Yeah, exactly. I love it. But Val, you sort of acknowledge the idea, will 17-year-olds show up and vote? Will they actually materialize in the vote? So here's my challenge to American 17-year-olds who can participate in this election, 18, 19, and 20. When Scotland was voting on whether they should leave the UK, 71% of 16 and 17-year-olds voted. 71% of children voted. They were empowered. They were told why. They did their homework. They understood the issue. They understood it was their future. I am telling you not right now, not that I don't agree with you with Howard Dean, but I am telling you right now, we met those Parkland students, Val. You gave me the opportunity to hang with them. They are inspirational. We saw the cover of Time magazine, and it wasn't Donald Trump. It was this young Greta who he can't stand, And when you begin to look at that, I think when you build that into the conversation about Trump and 2020 and climate change and guns and health care and everything else and student debt. I think there is an invitation in to participation that has never ever existed before. And I'm going to just say, I pray that Iowa proves all of you wrong and that they kick ass. All right, wait, hold on really quickly.
Can I just add a little bit of historical context? The civil rights movement in the 60s was led by young people, young John Lewis and others, and the anti-Vietnam War protests changed history and got Lyndon Johnson out of the race, all with young people. And they talk
and
about today's young people as being even better than the okay boomer people like us.
Right. Val, I'm sorry.
Well, you know, I hate to burst your bubble on this, and I hope that you're right. But always remember that youth have always historically been voting in lower numbers than any other category. Senior citizens, and it really does break out by age. And also, you know, think about the fact that, and this is particularly relevant for the Iowa caucuses, college students are different than they used to be before. They're most likely to vote out of the youth. But on the other hand, college students hold, you know, jobs where they're working sometimes 20, 30, 40 hours a week in order to afford their tuition. And many of them can't get time off to vote. And think about going to an Iowa caucus. You know, we have problems with people who hold two or three jobs that are impoverished, who can't take off for the 2 hours in an Iowa caucus. And many of the students fall into that category. Students love to say that they will vote and they want to vote, but whether they actually show up is another matter. And for the polls, we find that that's across the board. It depends on the weather. Mm-hmm. It depends, and who's ahead also very much depends upon turnout, right, and who actually turns out. And, you know, with looking at Bernie, one of the things that we know is that Bernie has surged because Liz Warren has gone down by about the same number of percentage points. You know, just as the New York Times couldn't make a decision between Warren and Klobuchar, I'm thinking that there are a lot of people who will get into the voting booth and decide whether they're going to vote on the progressive side or are they going to vote for a moderate. And that may not happen.
But let me say something so interesting here. So, you know, I thought, Stephen, that it was going to be all my progressive friends were going to say, okay, I got to make a progressive choice. All my moderate friends are going to say they were making a moderate choice. Actually, that's not true. They want to make a choice. They're actually like with a Ouija board. Who can beat Donald Trump? And if it turns out that they can believe that it would be a progressive, even though a moderate, they may hold their nose and do this. And let me just tell you, I've got proof. Let me tell you my proof, Stephen. I actually reached out to her. This is a black corporate lawyer from South Carolina who holds an elected position in South Carolina. She came out, Stephen, about a month and a half ago for Joe Biden. You know, she knows him. It's comfortable, whatever. She just publicly announced that she's leaving Biden and going to Bernie. And she said, let me tell you how I processed that shift. She is more Bidenish in every way. She's a corporate lawyer. You know, she likes Wall Street. So she says, I am looking at where we can build numbers. Biden doesn't have the capacity to build numbers. Mm-hmm. Bernie has the capacity to build numbers. Okay. So she saw that he had an ability to expand the base, and she is worried that the base alone will not be enough to defeat Donald Trump. And for the 12 or 16 persuadables that you could move over from Trump to Biden, it's just not enough. That was the first thing she said. Listen to the second thing she said, which I think is so amazing. I've reached out to her. She's got to come on the air. She said, look, I'm a corporate lawyer. I've been involved in politics. I'm an elected official. So Bernie will be president. He wants to do Medicare for all. He's going to do the Green New Deal. Well, maybe not. He says because he's got to work with a Congress that is not going to allow him to gallop off into the sunset and get this Medicare for all and get this Green New Deal. He may be moving in that direction. He may help sort of push us in that direction, but he ain't going to get it all. In fact, he's probably not going to get half of it. And I'm going to disabuse people of thinking that you elect Bernie and we become socialist America tomorrow. She said, because it's not going to happen and there's just no way. But, you know, not that he won't affect some kind of change, but let's understand how the system works. And we have proof of how that system works. Look at Barack Obama and the Affordable Care Act, written by the pharmaceutical companies and the insurance companies, and there was no public option. So isn't that interesting, Val, that that's how she processed? And it wasn't a moderate versus progressive. It was kind of understanding the calculus of how do I win in November of 2020.
I think she's reflecting a real reality there.
You don't think she is?
I think she is.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, absolutely. I think people, and I'm not sure they're making that decision right now. I think that they're making it on the day that they're voting.
So, Stephen, that to me was her interview was so unbelievable because it explained to me what I am sort of kind of hearing with all my friends who feel so undecided.
But I mean, I think even sort of that analysis betrays the sort of the basic reality that even people who are engaged in politics are not necessarily thinking systematically about them, because that is a description of any Democrat who is likely to move into office in 2021 with what is still overwhelmingly likely to be a Republican controlled Senate. Right. I mean, I think that it is unclear to me that there is an appreciable difference between whether a radical left president or a moderate centrist president has more or less success with Congress. I think neither of them gets much through the United States Senate. But I think there's another piece of this, and this is another a poll that I think also proves my point coming out of Iowa in the last week or two that showed that there were a near majority of voters who thought it was important to elect a moderate centrist candidate. And at the same time, in that same poll, a majority of voters of about the same amount wanted to see radical transformative change take place in the United States.
Well, and that's Mayor Pete's closing argument. Wait, listen to this, Dean Spiliotis. Mm-hmm. So I just saw an ad of Pete in Iowa. His closing argument is they're not mutually exclusive.
Right.
That you can get, it's time for us to turn the page. It's time for us to get a new chapter. And I am your new page and I am new chapter. And it doesn't mean that you can't accomplish both those things, that you can accomplish change. And of course, it's his definition of it. And at the same time, sort of offer the people who are looking for a return to the status quo an ability to stabilize the situation. He is making your point. And Dean Spiliotis, it's really interesting because he's hearing what's in that poll what's in that poll, and he's trying to thread that needle.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, you mentioned the decision by your lawyer friend.
Yeah.
That is what we've seen on the campaign trail is that is actually something that, in response to all the criticism she got on Medicare for All, Elizabeth Warren has started to build that into the narrative of her campaign, that we'll have a transitional period,
we'll
go part way. And she's been hit for that, too. And Bernie, on the other hand, Bernie is Bernie. This is what we're going to do, and it's going to be big. I think the reality.
Day one, he says.
Oh, he's full. First of all, let me just say something.
Utterly delusional.
Oh, wait. No. It's not even. And frankly, let me just say something. It is a lie. Let me tell you why it's a lie. Bernie,
day
you're lying.
A nice luncheon,
No. Let me just. No. Yeah. Remember Bernie's great line, I wrote the damn bill?
Yeah.
Bernie, read your damn bill. Because in his damn bill, according to Wendell Potter, and those of us who've read it, from Cigna, the whistleblower from Cigna in the New York Times, we had him on last week, and it was an amazing interview. Yeah. According to Wendell Potter and everybody else who's read Bernie's damn bill, it takes him 4 years to get there. So he's full of crap. And what I would love is, I would love that Elizabeth Warren stand up there with Bernie's bill in her hand and open to the page where it says how long it'll take him to transition and say, so Bernie, should we tell them the truth? Should we tell them the truth, Bernie? Will it kill you? It's in your damn bill. You wrote it. Now, I'm just saying to you that this is the problem, Val. She is getting beat up for something he frickin' does but never acknowledges it.
That was my point.
I mean, that's amazing.
Well, and I think that's part of another package, because I saw a poll yesterday that talked about the most likable candidates.
Oh, I know.
And Klobuchar and Warren out of the top tier were dead last.
I know.
And I mean really last. And so Elizabeth Warren had blinked on health care. And, of course, this was a strategic error. But we've seen Biden make these kinds of errors. But exactly. I would argue that it's amplified because she's a woman.
Well, Stephen, Biden's Uncle Joe. He's a permanent error. I mean, I hate to break it to you, but, you know, nobody shows up for his events. He doesn't get money. He gets money from big PACs. You know, I mean, he's like a comfortable old shoe, but the shoe's worn out. I mean, it's just, it amazes me, Stephen. And yet, I think she's absolutely right. All the females had lower likability ratings, and all the men were likable. And I'm thinking, what's this about? I mean, it's just – and one of the things that really bothers me about Elizabeth Warren, and I said it on WGBH, which is why I got a knuckle sandwich, is that I think she's brilliant. I think her plans make sense. But what she apparently is also missing is not necessarily the likability score, but she doesn't have maybe that political instinct. That professor is getting in the way of the political instinct that she needs, which is when Bernie sort of creates this illusion of the switch, she doesn't immediately say, no, sweetheart, I love you, but it ain't a switch, you know? Mm. That's a political instinct. But instead, she got a gotcha, and she got like a deer in a headlight look, and that didn't help her politically, Stephen.
Yeah. Exactly.
Something, you know, going when we talked about Pompeo and the NPR reporter earlier, what we didn't talk about was the fact that that reporter was female. And
yes.
I think it's hard to imagine a similar set of events unfolding had that reporter been male. I think the thing, going back to the sort of question of power that I was talking about earlier, I think that the thing for me that makes Warren, I mean, if I could pick one of those candidates and make them president, it would be Warren, not necessarily because of policy positions, although they align with my preferences pretty well, but because I think that she has done the most strategic thinking about what a Democratic president in 2021 could actually do using the powers that are contained within the office and throughout the federal government. I think that there is the greatest chance that she would be able to move the levers of the federal government in a sort of smart, strategic, sophisticated kind of way. And I don't see much of that conversation taking place anywhere within the primary, right? It's like, your president, imagine we continue to have a McConnell-led Republican Senate. What are you going to do and how?
Okay.
Walk us through it step by
step. All right, so Dean, I'm going to recommend everybody read The American Prospect. David Dayan is the new executive director or editor of the
American Prospect.
That's
still published?
Shut up.
Kidding.
I know. No, wait.
All right,
hold on. The American Prospect had as their, in the fall, put out all the things that a president can do in the first 100 days through executive power, rules, and regulations. And it is mind-blowing what they could do. And I think Stephen is absolutely right, Dean Spiliotis, that what Elizabeth Warren has done is looked at what is the power of the presidency, what is the power of the executive branch, what she could do through rulemaking, and what she could do through executive authority. And actually, the American Prospect, the list is mind-blowing. When you actually look at where the power is vested, and she has done that. But Dean, here's her political failure. She hasn't necessarily said that. And I'm wondering, is that a failure or is she afraid to admit that this is something she could do alone because this is the kumbaya, whatever?
So just to make sure I understand. So that she is not on the campaign trail. She's not fully embracing the potential breadth of Article II powers that presidents seem to have.
I think
values the word values the word blink, which is actually
blink.
I mean, she took such a beating on the Medicare for All that she did say, all right, we'll have a transitional period.
Right.
Bernie did not do that.
I know.
And then she took a beating for that. So it's like, as you said, it's almost like she can't win. She sort of
I think part of that is that when she is in front of a live audience, she does talk about what she will do on day one.
Right.
And
yes,
in some ways,
I
think debates this year have done us a disservice by not talking about what are your policy priorities? What do you want to do?
Yeah.
What do you want to accomplish?
Rather than
find the conflict between healthcare.
She also talks about how to sell it to the public and the Congress. I mean, the way she explains her policy proposals with some specificity and with facts is really a helpful thing. I don't know that she thinks she can win, but the distinction I want to draw is between what a candidate can say when they're running and what they actually even intend at that time to do, because it's fair to be and reasonable that in the democratic process, you can't say everything you're going to do or you're not going to get any votes. And, well, you know, there's
some leeway. What's the old Mario Cuomo line? We campaign in poetry but govern in prose.
Exactly.
Yes,
right. And
exactly.
Exactly right. But that's not going to win the election. And on that note, Rethink the Week, Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University, Stephen Pimpare, UNH, Manchester, and the Carsey Institute in Valangis. Thank you so much, Rhode Island College, for joining us. Always fun on this show, I promise you. All right, talk to you soon. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Arnie.
You're welcome. All right, how do we end, Ken?
We're going to end with Things Gonna Get Better by B. Houston.
I'm lighting candles
right now.
I'm hoping
things are going to get better.
I'm lighting candles. All right.
I looked all around me, and what do I see? Nothing but troubles and trouble and misery. Things gonna get better, just wait and see. Gotta stay by my side, darling, just you and just me. God's found my love, man, I say it's hard to find. One day, darling, you'll have some peace of mind. Things gonna get better, wait and see. Gotta stay together, darling, just you and just me. It's all right.